My name is Jeff with a G, the proper spelling. I have a bachelor's in political science and a master's in cybersecurity. And so obviously anything to do with computers and politics is of high interest to me. I worked for 12 years for a company that did surveillance monitoring, everything from this call may be monitored for quality assurance through to helping the government execute wiretaps and whatnot. So this is something that's really, really important to me and something that I find very interesting.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chris Segoyan. I work for the American Civil Liberties Union in Washington, D.C. I'm a computer scientist by training, but I work in a team of lawyers who do all of our surveillance litigation. So we sued the NSA about 2.5 months ago. I think 3 days after the Snowden disclosures, we were the first organization to sue. We're not the last, but we are the first organization to sue. And so I work on all issues involving wiretapping and surveillance.
My name is Blair Gentella. I'm an attorney. I practice primarily in copyright infringement defense.
Absolutely.
So a lot of these issues intersect with that practice of law. So.
And my name is Blake Sorensen. I'm also an attorney. I am a corporate counsel for AirWatch, which is a mobile device, mobile phone management security company, which is essentially a cloud data storage company. So a lot of these bills impact us heavily. I'm also a patent attorney. My primary background is in EE and software, patents, and intellectual property.
All right, so we are here today to talk about legislation that is going through Congress, the roundabout legislation that keeps getting defeated and keeps coming back. It's pretty much been going on ever since the Communications Decency Act. They've really started stepping up in the past a little bit. We've had one we're talking about today on the program was CISPA, but we've had COPPA, we've had PIPA, and it's pretty much all the same stuff just going in circles. And it's generally the same couple senators who keep trying to push this through. They keep getting defeated. They keep bringing it back with some minor changes. But essentially, it's we want to be able to do a whole bunch of things we can do now. There are some things they keep throwing in. There's like, I think there's a whole bunch of tax things as well with like Amazon and that sort of thing. But primarily, it boils down to we're doing this for your own good. And we want to be able to monitor you. We want to be able to grant indemnity to various companies who give us your information so you can sue them. Because I don't know if you know, the government's already protected. You can't sue the government unless you have the government's permission for the most part. So they're protecting basically all the people who are helping them out. I don't know if it's happened with the ISPs, but I know the phone companies have gotten sort of coverage that you can't sue them for something they give to the government.
The ISPs have safe harbor provisions for taking down material that's been accused of copyright or obscenity.
Does it include if they take down like a server farm that had stuff that had nothing to do with the original stuff they got taken down?
If that server farm was specified in the government order, yes.
So maybe it'd be useful for the audience to sort of step back a little bit and explain what's happening and where this came from. Can you hear us in the back in the cheap seats? Okay. So 100 years ago, the first wiretaps happened with the assistance of the phone companies in New York. And the phone companies have been providing wiretapping assistance ever since. The phone companies have hundreds of employees who do nothing but respond to surveillance requests. And law enforcement and the intelligence community, they have a good working relationship with the phone companies. They know how the rules work. You know, there are people they can call up. The phone companies in the mid-90s were forced to install sophisticated wiretapping equipment on their networks. There was a law that was passed called CALEA, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. And so the government generally has a good relationship with the phone companies. And for decades, the phone companies have been the one-stop shop for all surveillance needs. The phone companies know who you call, because the phone companies provide bulk internet access, they could provide information about what you were doing online. They knew your location. I mean, the phone companies were a trusted friend to law enforcement. And what's happened in the last sort of decade and a half, is that communications that were once handled by the phone companies are now increasingly being handled by Silicon Valley technology companies. So, you know, in the past, you would call your friends and relatives abroad using the telephone. Now you use Skype, or you use FaceTime, or you use Google Hangout. In the past, maybe you know you would your location would be available through your cell phone only. Now there are dozens of apps that are available on your phone that also have access to this data. All of your data is now stored in the cloud, so the government is thinking, wow, you know, it'd be really useful to be able to get people's emails or documents or photos. And so we've seen over the last 4 years or so, twice the FBI has floated a proposal to expand existing wiretap capability requirements from the phone companies to internet companies too. And you know, we can have a debate about whether that's a good idea or not, but the general idea is they want the same kind of wiretapping capabilities that the phone companies have. They want the internet companies to be able to provide that too. They want Google to be able to press a button and instantly provide your search records in real time, or your emails in real time, or the contents of your video conference in real time. And until this spring, it looked like they were going to get something along those lines. About a year and a half ago, another fairly heinous bill was proposed that would have required all of the internet companies to retain data about what their customers were doing online. And the name of that bill was the Protecting Children from Internet Pornographers Act. Genius legislation, because anyone who opposed it was, of course, in favor of child pornography. So that bill luckily died in committee, and it really looked like the FBI's wiretapping proposal was going to start going somewhere, and then something happened in June, and that was Edward Snowden. And now no politician wants to back expanded surveillance power. So for now, this stuff it appears to be dead in the water. It's unlikely that next year is a political campaign year in House races. It's unlikely that politicians are going to want to back pro-surveillance legislation next year. So I think we've got ourselves a little bit of breathing room. But really, the motivation behind these proposals is that our communications are now in the hands of internet companies instead of just the phone companies. And the police want to have the same level of access today that they had 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Well, I know you mentioned yesterday they had that group that was reinterpreting the Patriot Act. They couldn't just reinterpret that to include this over here and say, well, we've already got existing legislation that does everything we want COPPA and PIPA and all the others to do. We're just grandfathering it in, so we're not really making a new law. We're just giving an existing law a name.
Yeah, it would be difficult, I think, for them to magically reinterpret CALEA, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, to apply to non-telephone companies. Certainly, you know, Google's not a small company anymore. Google spends more in Washington, D.C. than Verizon does. They have a lot of lobbyists. Microsoft has lobbyists. Apple has lobbyists. And so it's very difficult to sort of sneak something past these companies now. You know, they have former politicians working for them, too. They're playing the D.C. game. And so the only way they can do this is through a legislative push that'll be expensive and slow. You know, if there's a terrorist attack, then maybe they can get something through. But right now, it would be an uphill battle, given what's happened this year, for the FBI to force these companies to basically put secret surveillance backdoors in their products.
Yeah, I saw a thing this morning. It said the FBI has just issued warnings about they're expecting an increase in hacking from Syria because all the noise we're making about doing that, and so they're expecting sort of a prelude to anything we do militarily there to come on the cybersecurity front in from that region.
Yeah, I mean, hacking is a strange issue. For the last few years, our government has portrayed the U.S. as a victim, right? China is constantly hacking into our systems and stealing our secrets, and that's probably true. But we're not just the victim. And in fact, law enforcement and the intelligence community and the military are all actively engaged in offensive cyber actions. We learned just this week that there's a unit at the National Security Agency at NSA that only focuses on hacking into the systems and networks of foreign states. We learned this summer that the FBI has a team of agents who do nothing but hack into the computers of individuals. So the FBI has software that allows them to remotely activate the webcam in your laptop or on your phone, to remotely activate the microphone, to steal documents, to obtain web browsing history, all without your knowledge or consent. And the reason we learned about this was because they went to a judge in Texas. There was a the case in which this came up was some kind of online banking fraud case. They had an email address who they believed was associated with the fraud, but they didn't know which country the email address was associated with. They didn't know the name of the person. They didn't know if they were male or female. They just had an email address. And the FBI asked the judge to approve a warrant allowing them to compromise the computer, to hack into the computer and remotely activate the webcam and take photos so they could figure out who was sitting in front of the computer. And the judge actually turned them down. He was concerned first that they had no idea which country this was even in, so he wasn't sure if, as a Texas judge, he had the authority to grant an order outside of Texas, let alone outside the United States. He also was concerned that, you know, if this was in an internet cafe or a library and there are dozens of people sitting down at this computer and the FBI was just going to turn on the webcam, that there are all these other innocent people who might be surveilled. And then he was also concerned that, you know, the FBI wasn't able to explain how they were going to ensure that only this email address was going to get targeted and it wasn't going to spread throughout the internet from there. And so the judge said no, and said, you know, come back when you guys can give us a bit more information and make sure that this is more finally narrowed. But because of that order, we now know they have this team. We know they have these sophisticated capabilities. You know, I think it's a little bit terrifying that the FBI can turn on your webcam without you knowing it, and that you would never find out after the fact. I think that is something that everyone should be worrying about. And as the FBI asks for more powers, you know, I think there's nothing more terrifying than my webcam or microphone and my cell phone being turned on when I'm not using it. But to give them even greater powers, I think is something that everyone should be worried about.
Yeah, and the problem with CISPA, one of the main, is that working right? Yeah, with CISPA is that it's so broad that basically, and there's no warrant requirement either, so the companies can voluntarily hand over information to the government.
Do you want to tell them what CISPA is? Because not everyone in the room might know.
Sure. Yeah, it's the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, and that was the legislation that was introduced in 2011. It failed in 2012, then they reintroduced it in 2013. Better? Okay. And so this is what they've been trying to get pushed through, essentially. Basically, what it does is it sort of turns internet service providers into spy agencies for the government, essentially, where they can turn over all this information. The government can do what it wants to with it. It gets turned over to the military authorities as well, which is bizarre because the military is not supposed to be operating in the United States. So, of course, the information that they can turn over, there's no warrant requirement or anything like that. So then it's just used and shared among all the agencies in the government.
The military authority was amended out. Right now, as the bill was passed by the House, the information can only be turned over to the civilian law enforcement agencies and not the military agencies. Right. But the senators have basically said that the House bill is dead and they're going to write their own version, and we really have no idea what that's going to look like.
The question there becomes, though, is it just simply a question of we're not going to actually acknowledge we're sharing this information? Or then do like the NSA does with the DEA and be like, yeah, we've got a tip that you should be on this corner at 4 o'clock tomorrow morning because something's going to happen, and, you know, bring guns.
We don't know where this is going to go. I mean, the good news for everyone is that there is political deadlock in D.C. So I live in Washington, D.C. It's difficult to even get a bill passed naming a post office at this point. And that's just, you know, that's either a feature or a bug, depending on your perspective on politics. But that's what's happening right now. There's a lot of pressure to do something around cyber. So the background here is that there are a lot of companies that there are a lot of defense contractors who have gotten into the cyber business. They realize this is a growing business. Many of them have hired former generals, you know, who've recently left the government to specifically do work on this in this area. And so every week there is a defense contractor, usually with one of their recently departed generals, going to the Hill and telling members of Congress that the sky is falling, that we are under constant attack, that China is stealing all of our intellectual property, that they, you know, the plans for the next presidential helicopter ended up on a peer-to-peer file sharing network. And so members of Congress are petrified. And you also have to understand that most members of Congress don't have an awful lot of experience with technology. right? Even the ones who are a little bit more tech savvy, the ones who are tweeting from their own phones, don't understand a lot about these issues. They certainly don't know. They've never met a hacker. If they've had, if their own computer has been hacked, it's because they downloaded a free screensaver and installed something they shouldn't have. So they don't really understand the threats, and so these folks come in, the lobbyists for these defense contractors come in and paint this really, really scary story and say the solution is this legislation. The solution is CISPA. The solution is allowing the NSA to obtain information from these companies about what their customers are doing, you know, or the solution is much more money spent towards cybersecurity contractors. But you know, the truth is that there is a cybersecurity problem, that, you know, things could be more secure. But there's no one in Washington who has the responsibility to protect your security. There's no one in Washington who, if there are 20% more identity theft cases next year, will get fired. Right? In your hometown, if there are 20% more murders next year, the police chief is getting fired. And they'll bring in a new police chief and they will do something about the increase in murders. There's no one who owns the issue of cybersecurity. And so for all of the talk about this, there's no one who actually has any responsibility. Now, I don't want that job, and I don't think anyone else wants that job. But so what we have instead is this feeling of panic and fear on the part of representatives, many of whom don't have the most solid understanding of technology. And they're grasping for straws. And the solutions that are being proposed to them are things like CISPA that, you know, is seriously flawed. There's no conspiracy here among the legislators. They're not trying to screw us over. It's just there's a problem, and this is the only solution that has really been proposed to them. And that's because this is what the defense establishment and the Department of Homeland Security and that community, that's what they want.
And there is, historically, the way that these things go into effect is a very broad law, a very broadly worded law will go into effect, and an agency or a department will take ownership of enforcing that law, and then they will develop the regulations as to how all the specific procedures work. And right now, the argument that's going around Congress is, well, yes, this is very broad, and it gives whatever agency this goes to a lot of power, but there will also be a clause at the end, and such agency shall enforce regulations to protect the privacy of individual citizens. And it will be up to that department to decide what those regulations are and how they're going to be enforced and how strict it will be. And sometimes that can work. As I've said, I'm a patent attorney, so I look at things from the way the patent office works. There's a very broad law that says the patent office shall grant a patent for something that is useful, novel, and non-obvious. And that's the law. And then there's a book like that on Bible-thin paper of regulations that the Patent Office puts out. And that's worked well because the Patent Office understands the technology and the legislators don't. So in some of these cases, handing this over to a responsible party who understands what needs to be protected, how this data can be protected, could work out well. But again, we're also talking about the government.
The good news is, you know, had Snowden not leaked those documents, this would be a very different panel. Had we not had those leaks in June, this panel would have looked something along the lines of, okay, we have the following three bills that are moving their way through Congress. They just passed through committee last week. You know, they're going to come up on the floor next month. Please call your members of Congress and tell them that you definitely don't want this legislation to be passed. None of us are saying that right now, and the reason is all this stuff is dead right now. NSA and DHS are both on the super defensive because of all of the Snowden revelations. You know, this is actually a really good time to be on this side of the table talking about these issues, because we get to wait and see what happens. I don't think, you know, and I don't know what my co-panelists think, but I don't think we're going to be seeing anything too bad coming down the pipe in the future, because I just don't think that any politicians have an appetite for you know, putting their name on a bill like this and then going back to their home districts and saying, hell yes, I backed even more surveillance powers for the government.
Yes and no. There's as with everything else, it's a very divided issue. And even among the people who want to do something, it's very divided how they want to go about it. There's one group of senators that wants to start putting in very small incremental changes. like setting up a particular department within DHS to handle these requests to coordinate with private companies and let them start working things out, and then take it step by step, bill by bill, where there's other people who want to go the let's pass something really broad and work it out later with the regulations. So things are still moving. There are still talks going on. Despite the gridlock, there are people in both parties who want to push this forward. It just happens that no one's really sure how to go forward with it. So, yes, we can sit back and wait and see, but we also need to remain vigilant and keep an eye on what's going on, because it could very easily pop up again attached to the end of some other bill. You know, we've decided to name a post office after someone, and by the way, we're creating the John Doe Memorial Privacy Monitoring Center for the DHS. That's the last paragraph of that bill.
I mean, I don't know how many of you ever saw Schoolhouse Rock, how a bill becomes a law, but there are a few pieces of that process that were not portrayed in that show, and one of them is the role of lobbyists, of course.
Yes.
There's a huge uphill battle for a bill to become a law. In fact, it's much easier to kill a bill than it is to push a bill through, and so, for example, you know, last year when SOPA, this outrageous pro-copyright bill, was proposed, and the internet community rallied against it, and, you know, Wikipedia went black, it just took, you know, a few million phone calls for politicians to realize, oh, shit, this is an issue that my constituents don't like. The politicians didn't have to do anything. They could just stay home. They could stay in their office that day and not vote, and then everything was fine. And so encouraging inaction on the part of members of Congress is a relatively low bar for us to overcome.
And that's they excel at doing nothing.
Right, and so that's all we have to do on this wiretapping stuff. We have to just convince them that this is too politically a hot potato for them to want to touch it. Whereas, you know, on some of the other issues that I work on, like accountability for surveillance, where we want more oversight, where it actually requires the passage of new legislation, then it's a real uphill battle. Then we have to convince the members to put their names on the bill and to pass it. Whereas just convincing them not to do anything, that's much, much easier. And so I'm at least optimistic on the front of not getting any new horrible wiretapping powers in the next few years, whereas I'm very pessimistic on whether we'll actually get any more oversight over the surveillance that's already happening.
I did want to take a step back. You mentioned the lobbyist factor, and earlier you mentioned that all these tech companies are very active in the D.C. area. They have their lobbyists meet with all these representatives to make sure that their voices are heard and to make sure that their money is handed over in the brown paper envelopes, and make sure that they get what they want out of these bills. And so, yes, a lot of these companies, Google's very good about standing up for individual privacy, individual rights. They're all about their open platform. Apple, you know, we can have this debate all day. That's another panel. They tend to be more insular. But at the end of the day, all these companies are about protecting themselves and making money. And so one of the provisions...
Google's not a charity. They're not,
right,
they're
right,
not going to protect, yeah,
they
you.
Have shareholders that demand that they not be losing money on this. And so one of the provisions in CISPA that is particularly troublesome from an end user perspective is the immunity and safe harbor for the individual companies that turn over data. I am on both sides of this issue because I work for a company that under CISPA would be required to turn over data. So I want to be immunized from being sued for an individual user. Because I turned over their data. I want to be able to say, no, you can't sue us over that because the government told us to do it. On the other hand, as an attorney, the contract is sacred, and the immunity is so broad in the bill as it passed the House that that end-user license agreement that no one except me reads that says, we will protect your data, and we will not turn it over to anyone. Oh, sorry, we lied. You breached that contract, but there's no recourse. It doesn't matter that you both agreed, whether you read it or not, when you clicked that I agree, you were taking it on faith that, you know, Google has a good reputation for trying to protect privacy. They've got it in their user agreements. But it has no value whatsoever because this bill would strip out any way to enforce it.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Is there any real need for immunity, though? Because if you're complying with a valid warrant, you're already protected.
Not if it's a breach of contract.
But I mean, most of the contracts that I've read, though, there's usually a inclusion that says we will not sell your information except where required by law.
And that's going to depend on how the contract is written. But in a lot of the existing policies out there weren't written with this in mind. And so the agreement that's effectively on record for these people is that we will not do this unless ordered to by warrant.
Right.
And this does not require a warrant.
So the reason you see language with immunity provisions in these bills is to get a bill passed, you need to give something to every stakeholder, at least to most of the stakeholders, and then you can steamroll the rest of the stakeholders. And to get the companies to agree to this legislation, or at least to agree to not fight it, you've got to give them something. And the something you give them is immunity, which means they can never be sued by their customers. Right. Now, I know you were probably saying it because of rhetorical flourish, but there's this idea that lobbyists walk into members of Congress's offices and put these envelopes on the desk and then just like slide it over and then walk out of the room. And so I moved to Washington in 2009. The reason I moved there is I studied surveillance. I did my PhD on government surveillance, and I wanted to figure out what was happening. And all the surveillance happens in D.C., and the way that I did my research was going out drinking with the lawyers for the tech companies. And after a few cocktails, I would figure out what was going on. And so I've spent a lot of time with lobbyists, and I've sort of learned how it works. And the money's not under the table. The money isn't paid in cash. The money is direct deposited to bank accounts. It's all above board. Politicians spend most of their time fundraising. That's just the nature of the game. There's a fantastic activist named Larry Lessig, who was a copyright activist. He created something called Creative Commons, which is a license. Maybe you've seen Creative Commons licensed books or images. And Lessig was this huge giant in the field of copyright reform. And he totally got his ass kicked in D.C. And after sort of sitting back and studying things for a while, he realized that the big problem wasn't the only way he could ever get what he wanted in copyright was by reforming the entire problem of money in politics. And so Lessig has some great lectures. He's given L-E-S-S-I-G. He's written a couple books all about money in politics. And if I leave you with anything today, because there's not really like a ticking clock on the surveillance stuff, it's to listen to what Lessig has said, like a half-hour YouTube video of him explaining this. Really, really helps you understand. I mean, politicians have to raise a lot of money, and generally, voters vote politicians in or out on one or two issues, whether it's their view on abortion or taxes or guns or whatever your like pet issue is. You generally vote yes or no for a particular politician, or you pick your politician based on their stance on one or two issues, which means all the other issues they vote on, they're never going to get voted out of office on unless it's a really, really big thing. So any obscure issue, that's where the lobbyists can potentially influence the members. And the members' votes aren't being bought, but the lobbying buys them access. It gets you the meeting. It gets you the opportunity to explain your point of view to the politician. And the way that, you know, when you're a company and you're a new industry and you get into D.C., if you don't want the government to mess with you, eventually you hire lobbyists. There are companies who've said, we're not going to play the lobbying game, and then after 5 years and they get screwed, then they hire lobbyists. And you know that happened to Microsoft, and they got investigated by DOJ for antitrust issues, and then they hired a gigantic lobbying team, and then it happened to Google, and it happened to Apple, and Twitter now has a lobbying team in D.C., and Tumblr is going to have one. Oh, I guess Tumblr already got absorbed by Yahoo. Every big internet company hires lobbyists eventually. It's just how the game is played. But what it does mean is that once you have those resources on the ground, you have people working for you, when there are legislative proposals that might negatively impact your business, you have people who will fight for the company's interests. And surveillance isn't good for business, particularly post-Snowden, right? Google's customers are not happy about this stuff. It's bad for their brand. And so insofar as we get more wiretapping proposals coming down the road, as long as these companies think it's going to make them look bad, they will have their lobbyists fight it. If they think their customers won't care, then they will have their lobbyists work on sales tax or other things. But the best thing that you can do on these issues is, you know, pick your internet company based on, you know, if you think they will fight for your rights or not. If you know you see Google doing good things, you know, send them a tweet. I mean, their marketing people in many ways are more important than you calling your senator, because Google's lobbying team amplifies your voice. And so, you know, as long as these companies think their customers care about this stuff, their self-interest will help to protect you. When they think it doesn't matter anymore, then you need to worry.
Which doesn't mean don't call your senator, do both.
Yes, call, please do.
Call Google and your senator. You're talking about money there. I know for a state-level position in Georgia, it's about $180,000 to get elected.
In ads and and other stuff.
Time space, media space. At the federal level, you're probably talking between $300,000 and $500,000 per election cycle. For the presidency, you're talking well over $1 million, $2 million a pop. So
hang on, to be a president, it's hundreds of millions.
No, that's per ad.
Oh, per ad, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah. So these guys are all about money because without getting elected, they've got no power. Well, they've got a lot less power. And that's also one of the reasons why when they step down, they get snapped up by companies willing to pay them six-figure salaries to pretty much do nothing but talk with their friends because their friends are the other politicians. And so instead of a lobbyist having to go and, you know, schedule a meeting or whatever, it's like, hey, Bob, let's go have a drink. I was right. That's a lobbyist right there. So your companies are willing to pay six, seven-figure salaries to these guys to just do nothing but sit and hang out.
The other nice thing is that former members of Congress maintain their access privileges to the congressional gym. So a very, very popular place to hit up your former colleagues is when they're on the treadmill. And to be a lobbyist with gym privileges means you have to have been a former member of Congress. So that is a very exclusive place. Otherwise, you have to, you know, go to a fancy restaurant like everyone else.
So yeah, there's and it all goes about that. And there's all kinds of ways of been getting around limitations on money. For example, one, I don't know what the name is called, but it's basically like check sharing. Because you've got a maximum limit that you can pay to any given politician.
Bundling,
that's the one. So what happens is, Chris decides he wants to go give money to a politician. I decide I'm going to give money to another politician. So what we do is we write out 50 checks. And I tell him, all right, for every person that you support me in a different state, I'll support a different person in the other state. So where I can only give $2,000 per state for a particular person for my limit, I can actually wind up giving $2,000 per state if he'll match me. So basically, we trade back and forth as far as that goes, which means that now, I don't think everyone here's got $2,000 to, you know, $100,000 to go drop on an election, but this is how the really big folk do it, the really rich folk, the companies do it, and then, of course, there's no age limit on whether you can donate. So, you know, if I've got three or four kids, hey, I'm donating in their name as well. So now suddenly I've got, instead of $100,000 for myself, I can now rack up $300,000-$500,000.
You sure about that part? I don't know about kids or dogs donating. I'm not sure.
No, I'm not sure about the dogs, but okay. The kids, yes. The kids definitely, because they can't vote, but they're allowed to participate in the cycle.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's free speech, right? It's
free speech. And so what happens is that you've now got the really rich folk who've got an incredible input because you're no longer donating to individuals directly, because you have to donate through the party. So the party knows who you are. They know how much you're giving. And because you're donating $200,000-$300,000 at a time now, when you say, I want to talk to someone, they go, we'll arrange it for you. So you no longer, as an individual, have to go and, you know, try and get a meeting and whatnot, because I've been up to D.C. trying to get meetings, and you pretty much never talk to the person in charge. You're always talking to an aide or a sub-aide or a secretary or something else, because, well, we're very sorry, but the, you know, this person's busy, even though you can see them in the other room sitting having a drink, just watching TV. But no, they're busy. So it's really all about money. Money buys you access. And there are so many ways to, I don't say jury-rig the system, because it is all legal. But there's so many little loopholes you can come up with, despite things like the McCain trying to limit how much money goes in there. They go like, all right, that's now a law, it's fine. Here's about four different ways we can get around that.
So I sort of derailed the conversation to lobbying and money in politics. I'm sorry. Do you want to get back to the wiretapping?
Yeah, I think we should probably hit maybe some of the technical issues that come up by trying to introduce this wiretap ready, especially over because the original telecommunications wiretapping, it's all done through central switching. But with a lot of the voice over IP and Skype and that sort of thing, it's done over decentralized network nodes. And so the only way that you can do provide this sort of access is by introducing deliberate security vulnerabilities into the software, which just seems like a terrible idea. Because while how much would Anonymous love to start hacking into people's private data using the law enforcement gateway?
So do you want to unpack that a little bit for the audience?
Yeah. Do you want to hit some of this? Okay. Essentially, I'm not sure how much we can. I can go into that, but because basically the law enforcement agencies have their own password or gateway to get all of these records. They don't necessarily even have to spend a lot of time with the phone company. They can just send them the data, put it into the network system, and it comes back automatically. But having to have all these separate companies introduce a method that these law enforcement agencies could access data. So now Skype has to have a way to do it, and Yahoo has to have a way to do it, and Google has to have a way to do it, and Apple has to have a way to do it, and they're all going to be building their own system. And you know, obviously, the first generation of software is never exactly bug-free, especially when it comes to security issues. So there's going to be a lot of interest, if they have to start doing this, in finding those security vulnerabilities and exposing them, because that's going to be one of the ways that, if there were this were to pass, that would be a way of protesting and demonstrating against it, would be to demonstrate the flaws in the system.
Hmm. So there's a great story. So, as I said before, the phone companies have been forced to put interception capabilities in their networks for more than two decades. In 2004, Greece was hosting the Olympics, and an unknown entity, an unknown person or persons, hacked into the network of Vodafone Greece. Vodafone Greece is the largest cell phone company in the country. They hacked into the data center, and they found the device and Vodafone's network that was in charge of all the wiretapping. Now, it turns out that Vodafone hadn't paid for the license for the wiretapping software, which is fine. They weren't using it, but they hadn't paid for the license, but the equipment was sitting there. And so the person who broke in very helpfully added the license and used the technology to secretly wiretap the Prime Minister of Greece and members of the Greek cabinet. Now, this was during the Olympics. This is a really, really high-profile event, politically very important. Sometime later, this was discovered. An engineer for Vodafone Greece committed suicide under very strange circumstances. To this day, it's still not known who had done this. But this episode, which has come to be known as the Athens Affair, there's articles describing it online, really is a demonstration of the double-edged sword of interception capabilities. When you put these things in your network, even though you may only intend for your police to use them, there's no 100% guarantee that someone else isn't going to break in and use them. And the other great example of this, many of you may have heard or tangentially know that in 2010, Google revealed that they'd been compromised by the Chinese government. So they were hacked. They said, this is not a good thing. We're really pissed off with the Chinese, and because of this and several other factors, Google decided to stop censoring search results in China, which meant they got kicked out of China. At the time, they didn't really tell us what had gone out the door. They just said that they'd been hacked, and it was assumed that the Chinese had broken into the email accounts of Tibetan activists or that kind of thing. And it wasn't until May of this year that we learned through leaks that the system the Chinese compromised was Google's law enforcement interception system. So why were the Chinese doing this? Well, were they spying on activists? No. This is where it gets really smart. The Chinese wanted to figure out who the FBI was spying on. They wanted to figure out which Chinese agents the FBI had discovered. And so any Chinese agent that the FBI had a wiretap on, this would reveal. It obviously very embarrassing for Google, obviously very embarrassing for the FBI and their partners. But again, what this demonstrates is that when you force a company to put an interception interface or backdoor in its network, you can never really be 100% sure that it's only going to be used by the good guys. It's just sitting there, and it's very, very attractive and it's going to be the target that everyone goes after.
Not only that, the employees of the company would probably have access to it as well. So there's nothing to prevent a pissed off employee from releasing a bunch of information.
Yeah, I mean, the NSA learned this the hard way a couple months ago, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, the telephone companies have had a long time to sort this out. They came in, I mean, when this bill or this law originally came into effect, they were dealing with the SBCs, the AT&Ts, these well-established companies. They had procedures in place. They know how to compartmentalize employees and how to secure data. Now we're going to be having to do this to, you know, Three Men and a Dog Incorporated, who just came up with a new voice over IP application. They're going to have to do this. They're not going to have procedures in place to control that information. They're not going to necessarily have the highest security servers. It's very hard, notwithstanding the break-in to Vodafone, it's very rare for anyone to penetrate a central office of a phone system, or to get into that sort of the telecommunications. But with when you're talking about software that's being developed by all these different people, there's almost certainly going to be a multitude of vulnerabilities that you've got to worry about.
So we have about 15 minutes. I guess we can take a few questions if there are any. Do you want us to use the mic?
Cut the mic.
Yeah.
And then I think the lady behind him was next.
This would be. Bring up I'll just project.
Hang on a second. Wait, because they're going to record this.
The ONOFF switch. Okay.
Better. Question mostly for Chris Segoyan. Some of the cyber penetrations really are scary, but the idea that we need more surveillance for cyber defense is almost a non sequitur. I think you'd probably agree with that. My question to you is, wouldn't this be a great opportunity for an organization like the ACLU to do a little bit of a hands across the aisle effort suggesting some reforms for cyber defense of the United States? You'd have enormous credibility if you did that.
So that's a great idea. I started last September, and I'm the first technologist they've ever had. If you were here in the previous panel that I was on, I mentioned that 4 years ago or 5 years ago, the ACLU hired another technologist who was a geneticist, and she worked with my team, and out of that came a Supreme Court challenge to two gene markers for breast cancer and ovarian cancer, and we won at the Supreme Court this year. We argued that breast cancer and ovarian cancer, that those genes shouldn't be patentable and people shouldn't have to pay 10 grand for a breast cancer test. So that,
that
wasn't me, that was my predecessor, but that came from having an expert working with lawyers. They just hired me last, 10 months ago. We're gonna hire another fellow. We wanna get far more actively involved in cybersecurity and in proposing sane, reasonable fixes to some of the cybersecurity issues that are present in some of the, I think there are solutions that we can propose that both improve security without harming civil liberties, and those have been sort of missing from the debate. And so, if you want us to do more like that, my colleagues would say, please join the ACLU.
And I should point out that the EFF did put out a white paper that analyzed the flaws in CISPA and proposed specific language that they would like to see amended into the bill.
Yeah, so my friends at EFF, that's a great organization as well. They do great work. We're a bit more DC based. They're not in DC. We have a team of lobbyists who specifically work on legislative issues. But if you want your voice to be heard, you sort of need to find an organization that meshes with your views and help them. I think the woman two rows behind. Oh, I guess okay.
Isn't the legislation really just kind of a false front? Because, they've already have the warrants through the secret courts to tap everybody's stuff out. They already have the infrastructure in place. Like I said, Google's was hacked, so it's there, and they're using it all the time. They have the large data center in Utah to store it all. Isn't this kind of just a, like I said, a false front? And shouldn't, since, Snowden came out and dozens of people before him saying the same thing, shouldn't we kind of use him as an advantage to maybe push and instead of, how they were trying to put in protections, shouldn't we try and put in penalties for them having that happen?
They want more.
Yeah.
They may have some capabilities and some statutory powers, but they want more. And the companies don't like the attention they've gotten. And so, you know, one of the things the companies really, really want is a get out of jail free card. And there are companies who are maybe more disinclined to help the government now than they were in the past. And a prohibition against lawsuits, I think, would go a long way to soothing their concerns.
A prohibition against lawsuits would help, but companies also don't want to have to spend the money to put this infrastructure into place. We don't have. I don't want to have to deal with procuring someone's third-party system to incorporate it into our computers and then find out that what we bought has a vulnerability, and then we get the heat when it gets hacked.
The government provides grants to pay to put this stuff in there.
No. No. Not that, under the CISPA. It would that, be full.
No, I mean, not related to CISPA.
All right, let's move to the next person with the microphone.
Okay, I have two questions. One is, with like Snap.do and some of those things that if you go to the Windows Store and get something free and they somehow in the background get into all your stuff, what are those actually doing? Like, who is actually getting that information? And can the government get a hold of, is it, it'll kind of back way for the government to get a hold of your information? Yes. And the other question I have is with our healthcare and everything having to kind of go into electronic medical records and the government gets that, how secure is, do they have things in place and how is that going to affect us? Because it's kind of like the same thing with like skate where they don't really have their surveillance. How, is there any thought or thinking about how they're going to do that so that our like health information doesn't keep getting hacked and put into the wrong hands?
Health information is actually a lot more secure than most of your other data because a lot of the hospitals don't have the immunity that comes along with some of the telecom acts. So they've got a very large incentive to make sure that their IT systems and infrastructure are very secure because there are huge mandated penalties in the bill if they lose that information. And on the topic of heavyweight lobbying organizations, the AARP is behind keeping health information very secure as part of the Medicaid system. So they keep a very close eye on anything that addresses that. I'm sorry, did that address?
And then with her first question, I guess, I think what you're asking about is behavioral advertising. So, you know, you browse the web, you go to Expedia, you search for a flight, and then for the next 2 days, all you see are flight ads everywhere around the web. There's a thriving industry of companies that monitor what you do on many places, many websites around the net, and then sell the opportunity to show you an ad to other companies. They narrowly target you and put you into buckets, so you are someone who's interested in buying a car in the next 6 months, or you are someone who's interested in low sugar diets, or you're someone who, you know, is, you know, whatever preference they have about you. That's a robust industry, and we don't know if those companies have been providing data to law enforcement. It's likely that there are other companies who have better data, right? Why mess around trying to figure out if someone is between 25 and 35 and likes sports when you can go read their emails? and so I think for now, the surveillance efforts are focused on the communications companies, not the online ad companies. But that could change down the road.
And there's a cool program that you can use in Firefox. It's called Collusion. And you can see the connections of all the trackers basically following you around the internet. Is that what it's called?
No, it's a different one. No.
Well, there's a bunch of them out there where you can actually secure your internet more and, you know, prevent the release of your information to people. So,
and I'm assuming all of you guys know what cookies are. Mm-hmm. All right, have a look at something called local server objects. They're like super cookies, but you can't get rid of them nearly as easily. I think Firefox, anyone that's got like a built-in plugin for that. But yeah, just go look up LSOs, local server objects. They're like mega cookies.
They're also known as flash cookies.
Flash cookies, yeah. And they can actually recreate themselves. So look into those.
My question is related in some ways to what the lady before me just asked. I'm interested in the implications of legislation like this on legislation attempting to govern health information exchange, HIPAA privacy and security rule, where the security governs electronic information exchange from end to end and is more stringent in its requirements than information, say, transferred over a telephone, and on the proliferation of health apps and health data that are being promoted under government development and other industry development. How do you anticipate any sort of interaction between those legislative actions and information exchange and what's going on under these?
The types of information that can be requested under CISPA as it passed the House was curtailed quite a bit from the originally proposed, and health information was one of the things that they specifically cited as not something that could be requested under CISPA. But again, that's still in flux, and there's a lot of debate going on. From a legal perspective, what we'd like to see is the specific reference to HIPAA, and that you may not request any information that is considered personally identifying information under HIPAA, and just make it very clear in the enacting legislation. But again, it's still in flux, and we don't know how that's going to come out yet.
You know, I wish I knew more about that topic. And it's the issue of health privacy and health security is certainly a huge issue. There are researchers who focus on this. Actually, Georgia Tech is one of the top schools in the country. I don't know if you're local, but there are a couple universities that do really, really good research here. Look, you know, with all of these issues, whether it's the security of your email system or the security of your health provider, they have to be good 100% of the time. They only have to screw up once and your records are out there. And, you know, hospitals make mistakes. You know, every once in a while there's a scalpel left in a patient. There's no reason to expect that the IT people are any better than the surgeons at the hospital. And there are going to be mistakes that are made. And I think the question is, it's not about what happens, you know, how do we make sure that there are never any mistakes, but can we recover from the mistakes? And when your health records do walk out the door, you know, what options are there to you? How do we make sure that you know, someone doesn't have this scarlet letter, you know, dragging them around for the rest of their lives because, you know, some kind of disease they have or an STD or something has now been revealed to the rest of the world. You know, I think we should assume that there are going to be breaches. There have been breaches. There are websites that just list health breaches, and there have been plenty of them. We should get ready for this as more and more of our records move to the electronic format.
Especially to the cloud. Mm-hmm. To give you an idea, the guys who write the space shuttle code, when it was still in progress, each block of code was about 500,000 lines long to control the shuttle. They had approximately, I think it was 19 bugs in 17 versions of that code. To give you an idea, on the commercial level, you have about 5,000 bugs for that same amount of code.
That's now, one of the reasons why space exploration is so expensive, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. But it also goes to show, because software companies who are providing the software that does all this HIPAA stuff, they're time-based. They're pushing out. They're trying to sell stuff. They're not. They're interested in writing secure code, but security is almost a secondary concern because they are aware there are multiple layers. You've got antivirus, you've got firewalls, you've got all kinds of things that we're adding to this. And they know that there are a bunch of other companies that are doing exactly the same thing they are. So one of their primary concerns is writing code as fast as possible that's going to work, that they can get out to customers. The downside of that is that's where your bugs come in. That's why tech support exists, because there are so many things that go into this that create bugs here, bugs there, and there are so many systems that interoperate. For example, if they're running something like that, you have to have at least three components there that interoperate. You have your database, which is going to be something like Oracle or SQL Server, which they don't write. You're going to have their software, which they do write, and you're usually going to have some sort of integration with like Microsoft Active Directory or something along those lines. Right, interfaces. Now, those things have all got APIs that work with one another, but it only takes one loophole somewhere to create problems in all the other systems. So you've got basically three groups that really aren't talking to one another, all trying to make something work together that's really secure. And it just doesn't happen. They do a pretty good job overall, but that's why you get so many patch updates, that's why you get so many security updates and stuff like that, because a lot of the times these things don't exist until someone says, well, this works really well this way. They do it, and they go, oh, well, but in some obscure combination of keystrokes, it opens up a hole over here, which can then be exploited, like the zero-day.
So let's go to, we have only a few more minutes, so do we have the mic somewhere? Can we get to one of the people?
Dave's at the back. He's in the back.
Okay.
Yeah. I use a Linux filter for my internet. I also removed a couple of drivers to prevent hacking of my webcam and various other things. Is there any other small steps you could recommend to keep certain people, even the government, out as a, for a home precaution?
Yeah, there's a really good low-tech tool. It's called a Band-Aid. So before I used to put stickers over my webcam, but the problem is when you actually want to use it, you have to peel it off and there's glue over the lens, whereas Band-Aids don't have any glue in the middle part. So Band-Aids are much, much better.
Painter's tape too.
Yeah, but, you know, there are many solutions. I like Band-Aids. I just think it's sort of cute.
You can also just turn the device off when, yeah, like actually power it off when you're not using it.
The part that scares me isn't the webcam, because I can block the lens. The thing that scares me the most actually is the microphone. Unless you're like opening up the laptop and desoldering the microphone, which, you know, if you're wearing a lab coat in the front row, maybe you're capable of doing. I don't have the electronic skills to do that. So the microphone is the part of my device that scares me the most.
Back to the legislation. This is obviously the poison ivy and or herpes of the legislation and technology. And it's going to come back up. It's going to. This time it's failed, but it will. It's still got to go through the Senate, if I'm not mistaken. They were talking about rewriting it, though?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's going to come back up. Who are some of our friends and who are some of our enemies in this field? The EFF is obviously pretty incredible for helping us know our rights and everything, but who else out there can help us?
So there are
ACLU.
So my employer, you know, is obviously spectacular.
Get paid.
There are senators who are really, really good on these issues. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's important to note that your senator responds to your phone calls, but someone else's senator doesn't care about you unless you vote in their state. But Senators Wyden and Udall from Colorado and Oregon are spectacular. They have been sort of the two most loud voices warning the public about surveillance abuses, and so they are spectacular. There are members from Virginia and from California who are also really, really good. I mean, I think what you need to do is, you don't get to pick your legislator. Wherever you live, that's who you have. Now you do get to pick them at the ballot booth, but you only have influence over the person who is in charge of, or who's responsible for your district.
Who are some people in the private sector we can look to? Google obviously tries, but like you said, they have shareholders. Who are some more people that we could rally behind to support, maybe?
Every company has shareholders, whether they're a public company or a private company. You know, I think what you should be thinking about is your economic relationship with the company who's providing you services.
Right.
I've said this on a couple panels already in the last few days, but if the company who has your data isn't charging you any money, you should really think about the relationship you have with them. And, you know, if you're backing up your data in the cloud, think about whether you're giving that company money. I'm not saying you need to give them $1,000 a year, but, you know, $20 a year goes a long way to cementing a real customer-provider relationship, as opposed to them treating you like a resource to be mined.
If you're looking for, like, specific companies, the EFF actually has a web page where it actually ranks the companies. If you've seen it, I don't know.
Yeah, it's called Who's Got Your Back. It's actually a great resource.
In the event of a theoretically perfectly secure system, would you still necessarily discourage mass communication logging? And if so, why?
So if we're talking about this theoretical world, can I have a pony too while we're there?
You can have a unicorn.
Yeah, I mean, even when your communications are secure, the records of who you communicate with can still reveal a lot, right? Which is why the NSA is collecting records of everyone you call. Of course, they'd like to know what you say, but if they're not able to do that, knowing who you call is still pretty good, and it's something they can do at scale, right? So if they know that you call the same person every week, you know, on a Friday night, they know that person is important to you in your life. And that's something that's, there are systems that will allow you to hide who you communicate with, but they are slow and not easy to use, and they definitely don't scale to 300 million people.
I was about to ask, how do you have any idea how good Tor is on obfuscating that information?
So Tor is a system originally funded by the Navy, and then since funded by EFF and the State Department and others, that lets you hide your browsing activities online. Tor introduces like a several second delay when you're browsing the web. It's unusable for voice or video. I mean, I run a Tor server. I like that it exists, but I wouldn't tell my friends to use it because it's so slow that no one is ever actually going to use it unless they think they're at risk. I generally try and advocate for solutions that don't have a high usability tax, where people are actually going to use them for everything they do, and those really don't exist for telephone or for real-time telephone and voice type of communications yet.
And even if you had the perfectly secure hardware and software, there's still going to be a human that has access to it, and you still have to worry about that person compromising the data and doing something wrong with it.
You're
for
not
example,
perfectly secure.
A Tor server administrator has access to your traffic.
Yeah, and in anticipation of this is my EFF day. This is the day of the con where I attend a lot of the panels, and I'm reading this old chestnut, the Hacker Crackdown, which chronicles what happened originally back in the 90s, which is kind of my era because I'm an 83 graduate from Georgia Tech. I spent 25 years in telecom, and I've seen the evolution of analog to digital, and then what the FCC has tried to come through with their regulations on being able to surveil, especially as we've moved from analog to digital, and it is hard for them to tap the digital. Besides this, do you see, I mean, we've already had SOPA and other things come through. Do you see on the horizon any new whack-a-moles coming up, popping up, that we should be aware of, that we should start tracking? Because this is all known stuff for us to look at. But is there anything out there, because I'm not in the industry anymore, I don't have any insights into what next avenue they might take?
From the corporate perspective, it's actually been pretty quiet. They're too busy fighting over budgets and sequestrations and gridlocking to get a lot done. So I haven't seen a whole lot of hot button issues coming up lately. Even this one, yes, there's slow progress being made, but it's definitely been backburnered in favor of other mostly monetary issues.
You know, I think now that the legislative front is sort of dying down for a little bit, I think instead the government is making use of sort of backroom coercion, one-on-one conversations with companies, a little bit of arm twisting here and there, you know, a carrot on one hand or the stick on the other. If they can get Google to voluntarily agree to something, no one has to know. You know, legislation is the way you force people, but there are many other ways to get what they want. And I suspect that they are trying those options far more right now than they have in the past.
And if you can't keep track of actual legislation, watch the legislators who promote it and who sponsor it. Because a lot of times they'll drop one but just pick it right back up again, you know, under a different name, or one of their co-sponsors will do it. So if you don't see anything in the bills, because, I mean, there's a lot of legal stuff to read through there, just watch the pet projects for the folk who are involved with things like SIPA, PIPA, COPA, all those, and see who the co-sponsors are and just keep track of what they're doing, because that's usually a pretty good indication of what's coming down the pipeline.
All right, I think we're probably out of time.
Yeah, sorry. We need to wrap it up.
All right, okay. Thank you all.
Thanks for coming.